Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law and Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, June 1st, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, our conversation is on supply chains, the role of Chinese equipment and U.S. tech. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Nova Daly, who is a Senior Public Policy Advisor at Wiley Ryan, LLP. Also with us is Sarah Jeffroy, who is the Director for Global Public Policy at AT&T, and also a Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Also with us is Cleet Johnson, who is a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer, LLP. After our speakers give remarks today on the subject and some back and forth time, we will move to an audience Q&A. So as our speakers are speaking, keep in mind what questions you have for either them or for the subject as a whole. Thank you all for speaking with us. Cleet, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Great. Well, I really appreciate it, Wes, and to Nova and Sarah. As well, this is quite a timely discussion, and the reason I say that is because one of the very first regulatory proceedings on this issue
has reached a pretty significant turning point today, and that is that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has a due date for its comments on a proposed rule that would prohibit the use of public funds through what's called the Universal Service Fund being used to purchase equipment or services from companies that pose a national security threat to the U.S. communications infrastructure. That's a mouthful. In short, it would be a prohibition on potentially certain named companies that presently are in the market for these USF-funded projects, and specifically those are things like rural broadband, rural health, the Lifeline program, and something that's called E-Rate that focuses on schools and libraries and broadband service. So this is one part of a much broader and complex policy discourse, but it's a pretty big day because it's the very first time that there will be a public record with stakeholders weighing in on how to approach this challenge of supply chain security and the more narrow challenge within supply chain security of how to address certain suspect companies that considered particular risks due to their potential use or being exploited by nation-state intelligence services. We'll talk a lot more about that in detail, but in particular, the FCC notice of the proposed rulemaking notes one Russian company and notes two Chinese telecommunications companies, and those are sort of the presumed focus of this rule. At the same time, on the Hill, both the House and the Senate are legislating on these issues through what's called the National Defense Authorization Act, or the NDAA. It's the annual, essentially the annual defense bill that sets policy for the Pentagon and funding levels. And there is a provision that has already passed the House that would ban certain companies from being used by companies that contract with the U.S. government. So it's essentially a contracting ban on these named companies. There's some similarity between the FCC order and proposed rule and the NDAA. Proposals. The bill has already passed the House, and it's it is pending in the Senate, in the Senate Armed Services Committee, but that it makes it look like it's quite likely that something in some form of this on this ban that bans specific companies by name in statute, which is the lawyers in the on the line recognize as a relatively unusual approach, is very likely to be enacted into law. So the backdrop for this is, and particularly with regard to the prominent Chinese companies, is about 10 or so years of policy discourse percolating, and what I would say is until late last year, really sort of a tiptoeing around the elephants in the room. How do you handle the perceived threats to the supply chain of these certain companies? And to be specific, what we're talking about is, can an intelligence service of China or Russia or another adversary, but in the telecom world, China is the most pertinent because of the manufacturing base, and so much of the telecommunications equipment and infrastructure is built or passes through in some way through China. Can the Chinese intelligence service, compromise the equipment in some way at some point through the components being assembled or being designed in such a way that that would allow for espionage, sabotage, even kind of warfare prepping the battlefield such that Chinese equipment is, allows China to spy on us or our allies. That's the issue, and this issue has been percolating for about 10 years in ways that have sort of tiptoed around naming the companies that are suspected to be the biggest challenges, and that really changed in the last 6 months. And what it moved from is from sort of looking at this as a complex global supply chain, and there are many companies involved, including a couple of Chinese companies, Huawei and CTE, that are seen as potential special risks, but not taking by name action against those companies. The exception that proves the rule is a House Intelligence Committee report back in 2012 that didn't take action, but it recommended action. But it was simply a report. It was not legislation. That laid out these risks and for these two particular companies, but other than that, the policy action was all about discussion about what to do about this, and there were some statutes that sort of loosely danced around these companies and what to do. And then over the past 6 months, there has been really a flurry of activity in just about every realm of public policy, from trade punitive tariffs to law enforcement, from the Commerce Department executing what's called an export denial order on ZTE based on violations of export controls law, to CFIUS action, and I'm sure Nova will want to talk a little bit more about this, but CFIUS action blocking an acquisition that's relevant to these companies in certain ways. To regulatory activities, talked about the FCC rulemaking process, to intense congressional pressure and action, everything from legislation being considered to a number of prominent senators in particular going on what you might call a letter-writing campaign to the FCC chairman and reportedly to the Department of Agriculture, which funds some rural broadband as well, to put pressure on them to push certain companies out of the market. And so we're at a real inflection point on these issues, and it has reached a point at which it is a specific by name concern, and that has some pluses and minuses in focusing in on particular companies. But the question is, with a global market that is exceedingly complex, and even one piece of equipment might be made in 20 different countries. The question about how do you address these concerns about espionage and sabotage that are very real concerns it's very difficult to come up with a simple answer. And this becomes even more and more important as we move closer to a 5G world. And those who are familiar with wireless communications will know that 5G is the fifth generation of wireless technology. It will enable dramatic increases in connectivity and connection speeds that will allow a tremendous growth in the Internet of Things, connected cars, basically all the George Jetson stuff that that everybody dreams of, and the issue about supply chain security, and also the geopolitical competition particularly between China and the United States, really is at the nexus of that. 5G is at the nexus of those challenges. So this discourse that's going on right now, and very pointedly with the record that's being created with the due date today at the FCC, is a very robust I think valuable discourse that is finally on the record after about 10 years of sort of dancing around these issues. We're finally meeting the issues head on, and it's going to be quite a complex discussion about what to do and how and the timelines and working out the details. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about those details, but I'll stop here having kind of teed up the issues and pass it back to Wes.
Excellent. Thank you, Khalid. Nova, I believe that you're next to speak.
Great. Thank you so much, Wes. So I'd like to thank the Federal Society for the opportunity to be on this august panel. My remarks and statistics derive, not only from my experience in government and private sector, including White House, and then also Treasury running CFIUS. So the helpful sort of publications I found on this, there's a recent Interos report prepared by the U.S.-China Economic Security Review Commission, the Obama administration paper on semiconductors, this administration's national security strategy, and also, I don't know how publicly wide it's available, but a DIUX report on China's technology transfers, as well as multiple articles. So China has, over the course of the last few decades, systematically sought to expand its indigenous technology and manufacturing capabilities, and has thereby sort of created a territorial consolidations in global supply chains. On the plus side, this has brought significant efficiencies, lower production costs, and consumer benefits, not to mention raising hundreds of millions of Chinese out of poverty. But on the negative side, this has also created dependencies, economic and national security vulnerabilities, and manufacturing job losses, not only for the U.S., but for many nations. So China's supply chain consolidation, its state-driven economic model, and technology transfers, whether it's through acquisitions, joint ventures, or cyber theft, have engendered a growing and significant response not only from this administration and Congress, as Khalid has noted there. And so I note the recent sort of CFIUS bill, potential legislation out there, as well as the Section 301 investigation of China's IP practices that has proposed remedies of tariffs on $50 billion of goods, potential investment restrictions, and WTO actions. Now, while there may be inevitably some resolution to those tariffs, and as Khalid referred to, export restrictions that impacted ZTE, I believe we're possibly headed in the near time to a less global approach to production, not only for China, but likely also for the United States, and with that, most likely greater trade and investment disruption, confrontation between the U.S. and China with global spillover effects. Given the experience of the U.S. export restrictions on the Chinese company ZTE and the essentially subsequent cessation of its production, China has made pronouncements, and it will likely more vigorously seek to consolidate supply chains and seek forced technology transfers. The simple fact is, as disorder increases, especially due to rising states and the challenges of economic and military power of an established nation, political, social, and economic frictions historically increase and likely lead to more balkanization of production. So reducing this friction becomes even more challenging given the diffusion of technology and the resulting mutual vulnerabilities shared between the U.S. and China in our telecommunication infrastructure and military supply chains. So the U.S.-China supply chain is deeply interwoven between our two countries, and we're very interdependent. China is the largest importer and exporter of IT hardware globally, per the GAO, so we can't avoid this interdependence. On average, 51% of shipments to the leading U.S. federal IT providers originate in China. This includes HP, IBM, Dell, and Cisco. These shipments impact companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, to just name a few. 73% of the shipments to Microsoft originate from China, and that's pretty significant. For China, I mean, just looking at ZTE, U.S. companies provide to that company 25% of the components in its products. For its Axon M smartphone alone, it's 60%. So the U.S. export restrictions not only shut down ZTE, but on the counter side have a negative impact on U.S. companies like SanDisk, Qualcomm, Google, and others that supply them. So China has become a key node in the global information technology supply chains, and on purpose. State-driven policies, the 13-year, 5-year plan, the Made in China 2025, are aggressive about the growth in these matters. So I think U.S. policymakers, given the interdependence and the plans of China and its state-driven model, I think they're right to be vigilant about sort of the national security vulnerabilities created by this interdependence. We have both defensive considerations, situations where we can't get the parts we need, and offensive considerations where we have to consider the public and private networks that can be breached and technology and classified information that could be stolen. So if I think broadly, given China's sort of state policy to foster its indigenous information and its acquisitions through multiple and sometimes inappropriate means, for technology to grow companies and increase market share through its actors and state-owned and controlled actors. From a national security perspective, I think we have become less concerned about sort of the nature of the relationship and more concerned about addressing the supply chain vulnerabilities that are directly confronting us. So U.S. military leadership has recognized this nearly a decade ago at the outset of the race for the production of the 5G technologies. In DOD's 2011 report on Congress on the military and security developments involving the People's Republic of China, it warned that information technology companies in China had close ties to its defense industry and the PLA, and in that report they specifically mentioned Huawei. So politically, disruption is arising fairly quickly. As Cleated note, there are multiple administration legislative initiatives either to ban, address, or restrict Chinese technologies outright. The new CFIUS bill, FIRMA, that's passed two committees in the House and Senate, is essentially driven by the Chinese investment mode that's increased rapidly and it seeks to take a firm focus on acquisitions of critical and emerging technologies and restrict them. There's a high likelihood that given the Senate version being attached to the defense bill, NDAA, that this is going to pass this year and it'll have broad consequences for Chinese U.S. investment and investment globally. And then also other things out there that are definitely showing the nature of the tumultuous period we're finding in the relationship. Senator Rubio has legislation and whatnot. So how do we move forward from here? I'm going to hearken to Thucydides. It said and implied when rising power challenges the ruling power, war is inevitable. China is challenging the U.S., but war is not inevitable, and it can't be an option. So both our nations need to consider the simple and significant steps we need to take to safeguard our individual and our shared national security interests, whether calming the frictions in our relationship or not letting the rivalry expand beyond an economic competition. For our part, we need to focus, I think, on to invest in the federal cybersecurity management framework so that the obscure and unknown becomes transparent And with that respect, we get a better understanding of the risk involved in Chinese technology in the U.S. systems. Simple speculation based on anti-China bias will only fuel greater animosity, so evidence-based action is imperative. And the core intention of the U.S., I think, generally is for China to compete on a fair and level playing field, and China needs to address that issue, especially with this administration. That's why I think the U.S. government and its actions is fairly justified in terms of sanctioning ZTE and to address other players such as Huawei, and China broadly flouting international rules and good governance. So I think now it's really up to the Chinese government how they choose to respond, and the tone they take will shape the next phase of the relationship. Those are remarks. I'll turn it over to Wes.
Thank you, Nova. Appreciate your remarks. Sarah, I believe that you are rounding us out. Please go ahead.
Excellent. Thanks, Nova and Cleet, for both of your remarks, and Wes and the Federalist Society for hosting this. Obviously, a really timely and important issue. You know, I think from our perspective, and I'll put my disclaimer in right up front that I'll try and frame some of this in terms of observations and concerns I've seen across our sector and beyond, and not necessarily just AT&T's internal deliberations or anything like that. But, you know, I think the overarching point that we have honed in on right up front is just the complexity and the broad impact of these issues really requires a fully coordinated federal effort. And there are a lot of different efforts going on right now, as Cleet mentioned. And, you know, I think we are obviously concerned with any legitimate national security threat to U.S. networks, and I think have always been good partners with the government on such. And so I don't mean to say that in a way to criticize, but just to point out, I think there's been a lot of discussion over the years about how serious the threat may be here, and I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing about how to address it, and that has tended to result in some differing approaches across government, any one of which in isolation would likely not have the intended impact. Cleet mentioned the congressional bans, and I think certainly putting something into legislation can have a direct impact, but it also has limitations. The bans that we've seen have been geared at either DoD suppliers or federal contractors across the federal government, but don't include those who are not. They've been company specific so far. I think at least the ones that are top of mind for me have named companies, Kaspersky, Huawei, ZTE. And again, while those might have immediate impact with respect to those companies, they're limiting in that, as I think we all know, it gets hard to rely on an act of Congress every time we have an emerging national security concern that needs action. These have primarily been done in NDAA because NDAA is a must-pass bill every year. So, definitely limitations with relying on Congress to act in all these situations. I think the other piece with the congressional bans, we know how hard it is to craft statutory language that gets exactly at what you're trying to get at without the potential unintended consequences. And I'm thinking in some of the language that we've seen out there, banning certain suppliers from buying equipment from certain companies, it may mean that you can't do business with that company at all if you're going to do business with the federal government. It may also mean that you can't use that equipment to fulfill your government contract. And those are issues that are hard to craft language around to do what you're intending to do there. The FCC's action that Cleet spoke to, again, in isolation, the FCC has limited jurisdiction, and I think from our standpoint, we certainly want to see any any ban or restriction apply across across the entire ecosystem, the entire information and communications ecosystem. And the FCC does have limited jurisdiction here, so ours and other companies' concerns are, you know, what does that mean from a competitive standpoint, and you know, how does that affect us as a sector disproportionately, or even within the sector, to the extent that there may be waivers and loopholes within a certain approach, you know, does it disproportionately affect certain companies over others? Throughout the FCC proceeding, I've heard from, again, broad range of folks looking at whether it makes sense to only prospectively ban purchasing of equipment. And what do you do if you're affected by this, but you already have that kind of equipment in your network? And how do you regulate around that if there's truly a legitimate security threat? What do you do with the existing equipment is a question I've heard a lot of discussion about. And the other is, I think, looking at the type of equipment and analyzing the ease of compromise, if you will. So if you look at devices and handsets versus core network equipment, there's a wide scale there, and I think those are just questions that the FCC or anyone needs to look at when they're talking about what exactly it is that they're banning and what exactly carries the highest risk that should be addressed first. We've heard rumors out there. Again, this is all publicly reported about potential executive orders in the works. From an outright ban on particular companies or somehow involving the use of IEPA and sort of designating a national emergency and sort of taking that approach. In my personal opinion, that would be very complicated, and I've heard a lot of different opinions about it, but that would require some really precise crafting, and it would be a novel application of IEPA, so that's a difficult one to tackle. We spoke about the CFIUS Act and that being used as an approach. Nova mentioned some of the things that the CFIUS Amendments Act would try and get at, including trying to sort of broaden the applicability, and that's obviously very difficult. Just given the structure of businesses that are out there and the impact of broadening that scope. Some other, again, sort of rumored issues that are bubbling under the surface. There was an article recently that DHS is undertaking a supply chain risk assessment, there wasn't a whole lot of detail, or there's not a whole lot of detail out there about what the scope of that might be. Some have suggested that the NSTAC, the President's National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, that this would be a good issue for them to tackle and make recommendations to the President on. They are in the midst right now of working on their cyber moonshot. And I think the other area that was touched upon is 5G and the standards bodies. I know that's a lot of concern have been raised about the standards making process and China's increased involvement in that, and we as AT&T feel that process is still a viable one, and the input and the levels of review that go into standards making is very fulsome, but it is one that requires an ongoing dedication to, both from industry and from our government as well. So a lot of different approaches, and I think absent a coordinated federal strategy about how to approach this, we worry that there may be some gaps, or if the congressional bans didn't pass and the FCC went ahead with theirs, or no executive orders, you could have any number of different actions coming to fruition and resulting gaps. in different parts of the sector and in industry. So just moving forward, I think the solutions that should be considered, and we've spoken publicly about some of these, is that the big principles that any solution or any strategy really needs to focus on are that the national security-related restrictions should apply to all operators, regardless of regulatory classification, and should be competitively neutral within the sector, within, for us, the telecommunications sector, and outside the sector. We obviously know communications carriers are implicated, but so are other companies, other tech companies, cable companies, that are important providers of an increasing number of communication services. And we want to see any restrictions or bans that are levied today, that they not disproportionately harm entities who have made decisions in the past, perhaps not to use equipment, notwithstanding a potential cost benefit, versus there are companies who've made decisions over the years for cost reasons that have made different decisions, and I think we'd not want to see a disproportionate impact there. I think certainly, and Cleet touched on this as well, there needs to be, for any of these, a legitimate national security risk and a consistent method for determining when there is one. The FCC brought this up in their rulemaking, rightly so, I think, for comment, and they proposed whether they may be the right entity to make those determinations, whether somebody else may be, like DHS, whether it's the intelligence community. There definitely needs to be a coherent way to identify threats and announce them in a public way that's consistent across the board. I think, not to make too much light of it, but in recent years, a lot of the public pronouncements about threats have resulted from either, as Cleet mentioned, HPSI's report, or frankly at some open hearings, having members of Congress put directors of agencies on the spot about whether they would or wouldn't use particular companies' services and equipment in their own home. And while that made the point in those circumstances, that becomes tougher and tougher to do in a consistent way, I think, going forward. And I think we certainly need to consider the business impacts of our decisions and that the proportionality of any action we take in the face of those legitimate national security concerns. There are a lot of legitimate U.S. businesses working around the world in many different companies, and as we've seen lately, those national security-based decisions do have impacts on the business community, and we would urge that to be a consideration in any plan going forward. And then the final point I'll make is I think we need to have a comprehensive, long-term plan to deal with the supplier issue. I think right now we have a handful of suppliers. All of them are foreign, and two of them are Chinese. So I think even if you were to ban Huawei and ZTE, the ability for those remaining suppliers to be competitive when Huawei, for example, is operating at a massive scale around the world just makes it much harder for them to do business, frankly. And I think that we need to look really at a long-term plan about how to address that and how to support R&D financially and otherwise to deal with that long-term supplier issue. So with that, I will turn it back over to Wes.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you to all of our speakers for excellent remarks. Right now, I'm going to open the floor to questions. So if anyone has a question, when you hear the prompt, you'll be able to ask your question by entering the star key and the pound key. Just briefly before we turn to the queue of questions, where do you see all of this going?
I can start it off. And You know, I think our opening comments really fleshed out the incredible complexity and both breadth and depth of these of both the challenges and also the policy responses. And this is truly one of those issues that you really can't touch one part of it without having follow-on effects in business, technology, security, law, in some other part of the economy or technology or internet communications technology ecosystem. So I think this is what you're starting to hear a chorus of this particular point, and it's something that, for instance, I expected to see in a lot of the comments in this FCC proceeding. And that's this, and Sarah alluded to this to some degree. There absolutely has to be a coherent, holistic U.S. not only U.S. government approach to this, but U.S. government, allied governments, and private sector response. Now that's saying a lot, and it will be very difficult to make that happen. And I think this is probably a multi-year process of determining how we set all that up. But it begins with getting the U.S. federal government's various agencies, and including regulatory agencies, but particularly the Department of Homeland Security, which is the sector, so-called sector-specific agency for the communications sector and the information technology sector. What that means is they're the non-regulatory department that is responsible for that, for those two critical infrastructure sectors, sort of like Treasury is the sector-specific agency for the financial services sector, and energy for electricity, et cetera, down the line. So DHS is sector-specific agency for communications and IT, and therefore there's a lot of support for DHS to not go off on its own and do its own thing, but instead to sort of be the lead coordinator and to lead the efforts in the federal government with regard to communications and IT supply chain security. What that should mean in practice is that there's a coherent process, again, led by DHS, that includes a lot of input from commerce, and there are several parts of commerce that have relevant perspectives and authorities, from NIST on the technical side to NTIA on the internet governance and sort of internet ecosystem side and digital economy, to the International Trade Administration on the trade issues, to the Bureau of Industry and Security on the export controls and sort of nefarious supply chain side of these issues. So that's commerce. It should also include input from the Department of Justice and the FBI, both on the law enforcement and intelligence side. Also, Department of Defense, both on the defense side and also the NSA intelligence side of things, as well as other elements of the intelligence community, probably the State Department for the international diplomatic considerations, and you get the point. On and on down the line, there should be fulsome input from all the relevant parts of the government, and that can and should appropriately include the regulatory community. And the challenge there is that the regulatory community needs to, and that means the FCC and other sectoral regulators, they need to be postured in such a way that they're enabling partnership between the government and the private sector, not sort of inhibiting or scaring away industry because industry is worried about more regulation or a regulatory enforcement action, et cetera. But they need to be part of this too in the appropriate way, because there, in some cases, there is some particularized expertise that doesn't reside elsewhere in the government. on the FCC side. For instance, the nobody knows more about the 911 system in our country than the 10 or so folks who work on those issues at the FCC. So they can, you know, they can have some particularized input, but it needs to be within this broader holistic interagency process. And so my prediction is that, that because that is so, it's such a blindingly obvious policy fact that these issues cannot be done in silos. They can't be done with one regulator doing one thing, then another regulator doing the other, and, you know, DHS doing one thing and Treasury doing something else. I think the fact of that will ultimately force some sort of coordination. And my hope is that the coordination will be planned and not just kind of have to happen because things get messed up so badly, but instead the government gets ahead of the curve and says, all right, we need to do this right. It needs to be coordinated. DHS should be to sort of chair the meeting, but we're going to have this interagency process that is coherent and navigable by all the players and has input from the private sector, which knows this knows the market realities best. So that's both a hope and a prediction, because I think it is likely to happen because there's enough recognition that it needs to happen. So fingers crossed.
Thank you, Cleve, for the very thorough analysis. Sarah, please go ahead.
I'll be the optimist here, which is unusual for me. what Cleve was just speaking to, I think, is from what I've seen in conversations and sort of looking at potential future activities, it seems like those conversations are happening across agencies in a way that I haven't seen before. So I'm also cautiously optimistic. You know, I think it's going to be a timing issue, as always, and, you know, seeing what comes out of Congress in NDAA, and you know, I think oftentimes in the absence of a big interagency executive branch action, Congress will act, and that we're at that inflection point, as Cleve mentioned earlier, that we'll probably have congressional action, but hopefully it is one that can be, you know, folded into a more comprehensive approach. I think that the last point I'll make is, as Cleve mentioned, the need for the regulatory community to reach out and sort of foster that public-private partnership is one that's been growing in the broader cybersecurity context over the years, and I think it's a really important one, but it's obviously a new area. You know, it's not the way of the regulatory agencies and the private sector in the past, and I think it's one that just requires a new way of thinking, and hopefully is one that will continue to grow quickly.
Thank you, Sarah. And Nova, do you have any comments or predictions or strategies regarding the future of the subject?
Sure. Yeah, I think I absolutely agree with Sarah and Cleve, and definitely Sarah, on the need for a coherent and comprehensive strategy to address this. Cleve listed a number of different agencies, and I think that formulation makes a lot of sense. In terms of where I think it actually goes, I think I sort of alluded to it in my comments. I think in the intermediate time, we're going to have more disruption. I just think we will. You know, that is part and parcel of sort of where this administration is in terms of the challenges, you know, the fractious sort of nature of nationalists and globalists within this administration in terms of how they want to approach the China issue. And then also the fractious sort of nature of what's going on with our allies and trade relations and working towards those solutions. But I think eventually what happens is, you know, as companies start to seize up their sort of longer-term planning, I mean, due to the lack of predictability in the market, you know, that's going to have effect on markets and broad economic growth, not only here in the United States, but globally. And I think, you know, when that starts to hit, I think this administration is going to start pulling things together. Definitely you're going to see leadership from DHS and the telecommunication markets. I think DOD is going to play a pretty major role as well, given the, you know, if you think about the defense industrial base and its size and its preponderance and how many providers are part of that, and then attenuated to that is our other intelligence agencies. I think that side is going to have a heavy hand in deciding which way to go. But I think, you know, either way, this has to be a coordinated response that needs the White House and needs the White House to lead it. I think in the past, in the Bush administration, these things were led by the National Security Council, and I think that's sort of the right body to take on a broad, coordinated approach. It's also going to need Hill buy-in with its leadership. So, you know, until things sort of settle out in these next round of elections, in terms of that direction, it's going to be necessary. It's also going to need a global forum to sort of create some rules. It's interesting that the UK and the EU, did two WTO actions, one against us on some of our tariffs, and then the other against China on its IP practices, which is in line with our 301 exercise on China's IP. So it's going to need some global direction, and I think maybe the G7 is a good forum to start putting these global issues into and maybe spill over to the G7. But it's generally where I think it goes.
Thank you, each of you, for your remarks. We have three questions currently in the queue and about 15 minutes left to the call. So let's go ahead and turn to our first audience caller.
Yes. The first speaker mentioned that it's likely that the NDAA will include a provision making certain named companies ineligible to participate or putting restrictions and sanctions on them. In the United States versus Brown, the Supreme Court struck down as a bill of attainder a provision in the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act that required that officers of labor unions sign affidavits to the effect that they were not members of the Communist Party USA. I'm wondering if that provision proposal in the NDAA would run afoul of the prohibition against bills of attainder.
No, I think that issue is a great one to flag, and it is something that has gotten some discussion in sort of the wonkish corner of the legal and communications the communications bar. In this case, I don't think, and while we're talking, I'm going to pull up a case, but I think it could be an issue if it pertained to a U.S. Person, but I don't think it's I think it's likely to be resolved in favor of the statute. And there was the case that there's one other very recent, only directly relevant precedent, and that is that the Department of Homeland Security recently named Kaspersky Lab, which is a Russian software antivirus company. You've probably seen the ads for it. That is widely suspected in the intelligence community of and the broader national security community of in some ways doing the bidding of Russian intelligence services. And DHS recently put out what's called a binding operational directive, a BOD, that directs federal agencies that essentially bans the use of Kaspersky Lab software in any federal agency network. And Kaspersky filed two lawsuits against DHS for that ban, and they were just dismissed. Both cases were dismissed. I think it was earlier this week. So while I think it is a good point to flag, I don't think that this is going to ultimately be a bill of attainder issue. Now, let me caveat that by saying I have not done a dramatically deep dive or legal research on this, but
well, I think it's a very interesting issue. I think this is likely, in some form or another, these by name bans are likely to stick, and even if they're thrown out, ultimately thrown out in court, I think the effect they will have on business decisions is maybe even more important, because I think a lot of companies will just determine that when you're making long-term investments that are likely to take place and live over multiple election cycles and different regulatory leadership, it's just safer to go with an entity that's not likely to ever fall on any list.
I just add in too, and I certainly haven't studied this aspect of this at all, but I think in the 2018 NDAA, the ban there, I think named Huawei and ZTE, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
Prohibited DoD from contracting with vendors that use Huawei and ZTE equipment as an essential component of the mm-hmm. technology that they're using to support their DoD contract. There may be some articles and whatnot out there from when that bill passed, which I think was signed in December, if I remember.
Yeah, that's right. And that was for Huawei and ZTE, it was specific to DoD systems. That bill also banned Kaspersky. I've kind of backed up the DHS binding operational directive and banned Kaspersky from all federal agencies. But with Huawei and ZTE, it was just DoD. The bills that are pending now go one step further. One, it's for all agencies, but it also is not just banning Huawei and ZTE for agency networks, but banning Huawei and ZTE from from being used by contractors or by entities that the U.S. government contracts with. So it's much, much broader.
Yeah, I think there's no. So yeah, I think that it's interesting is, you know, do they have standing in U.S. courts as U.S. persons, and mm-hmm. would it be someone else filing the suit? A U.S. person saying there's harm caused by that action, and who's willing to sort of take that. Also, interestingly, sort of tangential to it is within the CFIUS realm, there was a company, Rawls, that sued the U.S. government and the president for blocking one of their transactions, and it went all the way to the circuit court, and they essentially didn't rule on the president's right to take a decision to block under national security, but they said that there was a due process element that had to be satisfied. So when it gets into the national security realm, that's when the courts sort of defer to, I'd assume, Congress and also the administrative authority.
While we've been on here, I looked up that ruling from earlier. It was actually earlier this week, and one of the Kaspersky lawsuits was specifically about a bill of attainder, and this is a district court, so not hasn't been ruled upon it at the appellate level, but the district court judge essentially says that this is not a bill of attainder, which has to do with individualized deprivations of life, liberty, and property, and inflict punishment on individuals and corporations without a judicial trial. So the distinction that the judge drew didn't have to do with, as I was previously thinking, the distinction between a U.S. person and a non-U.S. person. That may be another obstacle to such a claim, but it actually had to do with the fact that this, what the judge said was that this statute doesn't inflict, quote, punishment on Kaspersky Lab. It eliminates a perceived risk to the nation's cybersecurity. And in so doing, has the secondary effect of foreclosing one small source of revenue for a large multinational corporation. So the judge held that this is not punishment, which is one of the constitutional prongs in the Bill of Attainder provision.
Thank you, caller, for your question. We still have two questions in the queue and just a couple minutes left today, so let's see if we can quickly get to our next question.
Hi, this is Chris Sundeneu. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Great, thank you. As I think about what successive administrations going back about 20 years in both parties have done, is it seems like they have felt that if the U.S. engaged with China, that it would move more quickly than otherwise towards a capitalist, non-authoritarian model. And to the extent to which the balance of trade got worse over time, there was this notion, at least as I saw it, that in the same way we talked about, you know, banks being too big to fail, the relationship with China being too big to change because of the disruptions. Now, I appreciate the panelists' discussion about how this administration seems to be going in a different direction. So just a couple thoughts or questions, actually. One, is it your sense that there's more of a concern about spying or electronic warfare, similar sorts of actual damage that could occur in the same way that the Soviets back in the 40s put the bug inside of the U.S. seal that they provided as a gift to the U.S. Embassy? Or is it more of an issue of unavailability of supply if so many of the components are from China? So that's the first question. The second, do you see the end state here being a limitation on the extent to which the military, U.S. military or governmental entities use these components, or even going beyond that to mass market consumer devices even being changed? Last, I know we have only a little bit of time. Maybe you can give quick replies to the extent to which you can. The third is the degree of connection between the timing of the administration looking at these issues and other related matters, whether it's balance of trade, IP piracy, jobs in related industries in the U.S. And then finally, what sort of things short of a fundamental change in the nature of governance in China from an authoritarian, non-capitalist regime to something more akin to Western democracies. What short of that do we think that the Chinese could do so that this issue, if not fully sort of resolved, would go more on the back burner? Thank you.
Sure. So, back in the Bush administration, we definitely thought engagement was the right way to go. I think there are a lot of the folks then now don't see that as probably the proper engagement. I think they agree that a little bit more direct, confrontational sort of relationship to get China to sort of change some of its practices is probably the way you have to go. So whether it's electronic warfare, fears or the unavailability of supply, I think it's both, but electronic warfare for sure, the OMB hacking, which I think was widely publicized, clearly Chinese, the prosecution of the five Chinese nationals for hacking Westinghouse, SolarWorld, U.S. Steel and others was also a demonstration of some of the vulnerabilities, and that's only the stuff that was made public. There's been others that were fairly significant, including possibly something with Google and other major U.S. companies. So I think there is a serious consideration that the spying, not only of U.S. government information, but also of U.S. company information and proprietary information and their know-how is important. In terms of sort of getting into through your last question, is this sort of like whether we think China really is going to change its ways? I don't think it's necessarily going to change how it seeks to govern itself, but certainly the way it's behaving sort of in the marketplace and in terms of intellectual property and indigenous innovation, I think it's something that they can do and they can adjust to, and the openness to sort of investment and wholly owned subsidiaries is something they can do, and I think they eventually will take that on as long as there's a global movement to do so. In terms of timing, IP, and jobs, I think it's all sort of reached a grand crescendo, and that's why you're seeing all these actions. And your second question, I'll just let others address.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Cleve, Sarah, do you have a response to the second question?
The question dealt with whether the actions that we're talking about here are likely to be limited for supply by U.S. military or governmental entities, or the notion is that there would also be limitations on the extent to which mass market consumers would have devices that we might purchase no longer be able to use Chinese components?
So I think it, certainly in the past the focus has been on the former. Hard to predict where it will go, but I think it at the very least could have the consequence of impacting consumer services and equipment as well. You know, whether that's the intention right now, I think some of these the actions that we've seen have certainly broadened a bit more, you know, incrementally broadened towards what they would impact. So, you know, hard to say if that would be an intended priority soon, but I could certainly see an impact occurring there.
Yeah, I think the just to add to that, I think that's right. The lever that's being used in the immediate near term is government funding. So you're talking mostly about government-funded networks on the government network side, and also in the FCC setting, government-subsidized purchases for private sector deployment of broadband and other networking. So you're primarily talking about that sort of critical infrastructure side of things, be it government networks or this government-funded infrastructure. But it's having a pretty significant ripple effect on the downstream. And I think it will inevitably, particularly along with the other policy actions like the punitive trade tariffs and the commerce action on CTE, it either legally or just in the practical business impact will have a pretty significant effect more broadly than just those government procurement scenarios. And the value of this discourse is to really suss out where the risks are, what the appropriate actions are. Because frankly, I think if you've talked to a number of the policymakers about this, they're either conflating a lot of these different risks and threats, or they are not yet parsing them out and looking at them distinctly. So the value of this policy process is that we're finally going to start digging into the distinctions and what to do about which threats.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Looks like we are at the end of our time today. So I just want to let everyone know that this call is being recorded. It's going to be turned into a podcast and uploaded to our website, and you can download it on Google Play and iTunes and the Federal Society's website. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.